Welcome back, weirdos. We have a very special episode for you all this week. It is 420, and it is also our very first interview for the podcast. We had the pleasure of having David Bienenstock, the author of How to Smoke Pot Properly, a highbrow guide to getting high, and creator and host of the popular podcast Great Moments in Weed History, on the show. Previously, David served as the head of content at High Times and was a producer at Vice Media, where he created the video series Bong Appetit, including viral episodes like A Gourmet Weed Dinner at Hunter S. Thompson's House and Marijuana Nona. I unfortunately was unable to attend this episode, but Andrew had the pleasure of interviewing David. I've listened to this episode. Weirdos, you are in store for so much amazing weird weed facts for this one. So we hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to History for Weirdos.
We are your hosts, Andrew
and Stephanie.
And each week, we're going to take you on a journey into the strange, obscure, and relentlessly entertaining corners of human history.
Now listen up, friends, because it's about to get weird.
David, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast.
It is my pleasure. I obviously have a big interest in history, and I would proudly self-identify as a weirdo, so I feel I'm very much in the right place and a fan of your show and happy to be here.
Awesome. Thanks so much, man. So first things first, you are a cannabis journalist. You're a cannabis historian. What does that entail? You know, walk us through what that looks like.
Sure. Well, it's been a long process for me. I've been writing about cannabis for 20 years, really. My first, not my first job in journalism, but my first job in weed was on staff at High Times Magazine. I always say back when it was cool. Some pretty messed up people have unfortunately taken over there. But when I was there, it was an independent publication. It was founded in the 70s, long before my time, by a radical political activist, a cannabis smuggler, and a big part of the underground press movement of the era, somebody named Tom Forsad. If you're really interested in that story, there's a whole two-part episode of Great Moments in Weed History about him. Unfortunately, he passed away long before my time there. But that was at a time and a place where every cannabis journalist working full-time on that beat really all worked at the same place. There was not a lot of cannabis media going back that far. I've had an interest in cannabis since I was a teenager, and of course, like everyone else, you know, that maybe not like everyone else, but I enjoyed weed. I got a lot out of it. I definitely had medicinal uses for it, and it really helped me in so many ways, change my relationship to myself, change my relationship to other people, deal with, you know, everything from, you know, anxiety and some anger issues and all of that. So cannabis has always been important to me. And then when the, you know, I was a working journalist and I responded to a want ad and it turned out to be for High Times, and it really changed the whole course of my life. And I think what's really kept me going is that when you are writing about cannabis or making media about cannabis, I do the podcast, I've worked on television shows, it's really, you know, the plant itself is beautiful and fascinating and an incredible medicine, but it's also the people that you come in contact with and the subjects that you cover. To cover mm-hmm. cannabis is to cover the criminal justice system, to cover medicine, law, art and culture, botany, farming, all of these, you know, agriculture in the broadest sense. You know, I recently was writing about attempts to patent cannabis, you know, and it's an opportunity to take a deep dive into how patent law works. And so fascinating people and intersecting with all of these other really important issues. And then on a more personal level, you know, like I would think any thinking person, to get so much benefit out of a plant and a culture, and then to also see the terrible oppression of people, this racist system of prohibition, you know, and you know, in my earliest time writing about cannabis, I was at High Times, a very celebratory publication. But because of my background, I was often writing articles about people who were being targeted by this war on cannabis and the larger war on drugs. And my outrage over seeing so many people arrested, having their lives torn apart, people having their children taken away for having cannabis, people losing their jobs, people, of course, going to prison. You know, that has been a huge motivating factor to want to do this work. And of course, when I talk about the kind of people that you get to interact with, that includes all the fascinating characters from the ethical underground, your growers, your smugglers, your dealers. It's just this sort of beautiful place in society where people are breaking the law and living an outlaw lifestyle, but not doing something harmful, and in fact doing something very beneficial, because without the people who broke the law, there would be no cannabis. And that would be its own tragedy, but also we never would have gotten to this point of legalizing cannabis if there wasn't a supply of cannabis for people to understand with direct experience that these laws are based on propaganda and lies and the perpetuation of the prison industrial complex and the suppression of people of color and people with less money and other marginalized groups. So it's been to me just an honor and a privilege in any way to try to represent this culture and reflect this culture and report on this culture. And it's also been a lot of fun.
Awesome. I'm so glad to hear that. I have so many questions, but I guess the first things first is it seems that a lot of cannabis influences patent law. It influences the judicial system, right? It influences quite a bit. And then I think those laws, our culture and whatever else you want to throw in there also influences cannabis. So it seems like it's like almost like a cyclical cycle, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It certainly goes both ways. And I've been at this long enough to, you know, really bridge an era. You know, one thing that we should, of course, say off the top is humans have been interacting with cannabis for up to 10,000 years.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm the ancient history guy and, you know, in history for weirdos. So I would love for you just to dive right in. Where did cannabis come from, right? The last time I checked, and again, this might not even be the most current information, but it was around 10,000 years ago, kind of in the Central Eurasian steppe, almost like Kazakhstan, China, Afghanistan, that kind of region, right?
That's certainly the most compelling evidence that I've seen. And, you know, no less a eminence than Carl Sagan, who was also a huge stoner in his time. And we could talk more about that. But he speculated in one of his books that perhaps cannabis was the first domesticated crop, the first crop that sparked humanity's journey with agriculture. And it certainly makes a lot of sense. You know, that doesn't mean that there wasn't awareness of plants. You obviously had to eat, but as people were foragers and nomadic, they would simply access plants as they encountered them and had an understanding of moving through the environments of what plants would be beneficial for different purposes, but that perhaps this very special plant was the one that inspired people to get high on their own supply, as it were. And so that tells you how, you know, foundational it was in that sense. And then we've had an episode, several episodes of Great Moments in Weed History about cannabis in the ancient world through different spiritual practices, because that tends to be what's best documented. You know, one of the oldest sites in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and this is only in the last 5 years, archaeologists have discovered that in, you know, in essence, what's called the holiest of holies, the central chamber of these religious sites, on altars that would have been really accessible only to the most central figures in these religious groups, they're finding cannabis resin. You know, and really, you can read the Bible, and every time it says incense, you can just think hashish.
Yes.
And of course, this is not the only religious tradition where we find direct, irrefutable evidence. This is in the Hindu tradition, in stories like Shiva, and in the Vedas. They're some of the oldest existing spiritual texts. I had an episode of the show where I had a professor of Islamic history talking about hashish, which is just a concentrated form of cannabis, in that religious tradition, and also in the trade routes of that time. And, you know, there's also sort of older pre-monotheistic religious traditions where there's, you know, direct strong evidence. I recently had an episode about an ancient Chinese goddess called Magu, who was the hemp goddess and also associated with the elixir of life. So, you know, these are not subtle or tangential parts of these religious traditions. And then, of course, we see these plant medicines and these deities around them and these practices challenged and suppressed, and sometimes brutally suppressed, by the rise of monotheism. And in my opinion, it's because cannabis and other plant medicines like cannabis can offer people a direct connection to the divine. And if you are running a hierarchical religious movement that wants to dictate through dogma what spiritual practices should be, and give you sort of a second-hand experience of the divine, well, they don't want you to experience it directly because it takes away their power over you. So, you know, that's, you know, to me, something that I think most people don't understand. There's these big misconceptions that, like, oh, weed smoking started in the 60s with a bunch of hippies. And you know, even as just a more modern example, we have a great episode, and in an American example, jazz musicians in the 1920s and 30s, there's dozens and dozens of songs about weed from some of the biggest artists of that era, you know? So it's really important to take a long, long view and understand that prohibition is the anomaly, and prohibition is a largely modern phenomenon, and that our relationship with cannabis is much longer and much deeper than most people realize.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And going back to the pre-monotheistic era, right? I think one of the most compelling and interesting like case studies comes out of ancient Egypt. I know that I believe even Ramses the Great has marijuana in his hair, right? So he ingested marijuana shortly before he died. Like, we have the DNA, we have his mummy, we have the DNA evidence. And I know he's not the only new kingdom pharaoh to have that. And as well, not the Egyptians. Famously, I mean, if you could talk about the Scythians, I know that they kind of invented, to our knowledge, like hotboxing, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, we're relying on an account of, maybe you can help me with this. Is it Herodotus?
Herodotus. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
I feel like he'd be cool about it, because the only thing I know about him is that he wrote this account of the Scythians, and he is describing them in essence, creating the first hotbox, which, if you're not familiar, the modern iteration of the hotbox is usually smoking a bunch of weed in a car with the windows rolled down. Perfectly safe as long as you're not driving. Don't hotbox and drive, but otherwise you'll be fine. A famous hotboxer in history is former President Obama. wrote in his own, there was a book that came out about his weed smoking years, and he was a big proponent of hotboxing the car with his group of friends at the time, which was known as the Choom Gang. And now this is their nickname for his high school friends, and Choom was a local Hawaiian slang for smoking weed. So it's not like Obama smoked once or twice. He was part of a group called the Choom Gang that was into hotboxing. And I guess it's because, as a pretty thoughtful guy himself, he wanted to honor this ancient tradition of the Scythians, who would, in essence, build a small mound, go inside, build a fire, and throw little balls of hashish into the fire until the smoke released would fill this space. And, you know, of course, when you go back pre-prohibition to these ancient times, you know, cannabis did not cost the equivalent of 50 shekels for an eighth. You know, it was quite right. Plentiful. So, yeah, definitely a great another one of the really oldest, very well documented stories around weed.
I know. I personally love that, because in my mind, the ancient Scythians did influence all the 70s stoner movies, right? Like, I love that there's like that ancient connection. It definitely tugs at my heartstrings. So, kind of moving forward, do we know a lot about like marijuana in the like late antiquity? Like, so like this is like the very early portions of Christianity, and then anywhere through the Middle Ages, do we know like how that existed in both the Christian and Islamic worlds?
Yeah. And I it sounds like I'm plugging a lot, but I have much, very detailed episodes about some of these issues. And I'm a historian of weed in that I've done over 100 episodes of this show. And I do put scholarship into them, but I don't hold all of this information in my head, so I would point people to the episodes. But we have an entire episode about Jesus and cannabis, and I don't know if you're familiar with a group called the Gnostics, but they, in essence, it's this alternative telling of the life of Jesus that was again, suppressed at the time when the canonization of the Gospels that you would find in the King James Bible, for example, when, you know, there were all these accounts of the life of Christ, and then they picked certain ones, and of course things were taken out and put in, and whatever you think about that. And I'm not here to dispel people's religious beliefs, but the story is, in essence, that, there's baptism as a ritual and a rite that is done, a rite, R-I-T-E, but sure, also R-I-G-H-T, why not? Yeah. But Christ, when we call Jesus, Jesus Christ, it wasn't his last name. His father was not Bill Christ. Christ right. means the anointed one, or to anoint. And the anointing that is being described is the anointing from the Old Testament. If you go to the Old Testament, and it is an anointing in oil through the skin, if you go to the Old Testament, there is only one recipe in it. There's not a hummus recipe. There's not a chopped liver recipe. There's the, but there is a recipe for making this anointing oil, and it contains, I think, 8 pounds of a substance that is described as cannabosum. Okay. Now, when that was translated into Greek, and from there, every other sort of modern Bible, they claim it's calamus, but it's clearly and obviously a reference to cannabis. I mean, it sounds exactly like cannabis, and the descriptions of this anointing oil, you know, when Jesus has visions, it is after being anointed. And when Jesus and his disciples perform healing miracles, it is with anointing oil. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, and many of the conditions that, you know, from, you know, now we have this very sophisticated understanding of the, healing powers of this plant, of its medicinal uses. One of the most striking ones is, if you've ever seen, as an example, Sanjay Gupta's special about children with seizure disorders, mm-hmm. who, you know, some of whom were having hundreds of serious seizures a month, and then with the application of cannabis, those seizures would stop.
Yes.
The cannabis that's being given to those children, of course, you know, it might be a different blend, or it might be in the form of a pill. They're not being anointed in oil. But those same medicinal effects would work in Jesus's time no differently than they would work now. So if you can imagine somebody who, and in the Old Testament, that anointing oil was supposed to be kept to the priest class, to, you know, the insiders of these religious movements. And in essence, Jesus breaks this prohibition. One of the things that makes him the radical figure that he is, who is ultimately murdered by the state, mm-hmm. It's capital punishment, you know, for, you know, heresy or these crimes or whatever. But the anointing, he breaks the prohibition on anointing and tells his disciples, I wish I had all the quotes and all the sort of primary evidence that is in the episode, but he in essence tells his disciples, take this oil and heal people. This oil that contains cannabosum. And if you can imagine, you know, the equivalent 8-year-old girl to the ones, you know, the one who was the focus of this Sanjay Gupta special, someone comes to your village in ancient Judea, there's a child who has probably always been considered to be possessed by the devil. There was not the sophisticated understanding of seizure disorders. We still struggle to understand them.
Right.
And applies this oil to the skin. Now, some of the other ingredients in this oil is like cinnamon and other plants that help the absorption, that break down the barriers in the skin to absorbing anything that way, including cannabis. These were sophisticated people. You know, we also have this tendency to just think, oh, because they didn't have skyscrapers, they must not have been sophisticated. They knew a lot about what they knew about. And this is a formula to bring cannabis's medicinal compounds into the body. And of course, that would seem like a miracle. It still seems like a miracle now. You know, right. Imagine being a family who has your entire life, your child has had this severe seizure disorder. And so, you know, that really gets to the question of what was Jesus all about? And really about healing.
Right.
And plant medicine. And so, and when you see that the name Jesus Christ that he's given by his disciples refers to this anointing, and yet that anointing oil is in modern Christianity not talked about and certainly not done, and this baptism, which is a bit of a placebo for the actual anointing, and in some of these Gnostic texts. So in essence, then how do we know all this if these texts were suppressed? Right. Well, there was like people of the era who realized that this knowledge was going to be lost, and sometime in the 1850s, please everyone forgive me for minor inaccuracies, and but
as long as you're generally correct, I think that's all that matters. Yeah.
Sometime in the 1850s, somebody discovered in a cave a sort of box set of all these Gnostic texts, and recovered this. And there's a quote in one of them, something like, referring to baptism and anointing, and it says, "In baptism is water, and in water is water, but in anointing oil there is fire." Like, this is the central mission of Christ and why he was given the name Christ. So you know, I've done some of all the things I've ever done. I did a little video about this story that went out on a pretty popular platform called Now This. And I got just the most interesting emails and messages from that, from people who were holding these two things in their lives, people who really had a relationship with Jesus, had either come up with it or had found it, and had a relationship with this plant and its healing powers. And not just, you know, you can heal your soul, you can heal your body, you can heal your mind, an expansive view of what healing is. And for the first time, we're able to see that they were really the same story. So to me, of all the kind of episodes we've done on the show, I felt like that really reached people in a unique way. And in the way that I know both of us as lovers of history understand that it's not just to look back and be fascinated, it's to look back and see our own lives and experiences in a different way.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I've always viewed history personally as the story of humanity, right? I mean, and how we've changed so much. And also, it's a great case study, right? You have people who have done certain things, and you can say like, oh, that worked out pretty well. Or you could say, well, that didn't work out very well. But it's interesting you talk about anointing as kind of like this, almost like a spiritual ritual, religious ritual, because I know in the Greco-Roman tradition, going back all the way to the Mycenaean Greeks, so it's like the ancient Greeks to the ancient Greeks, even in the Odyssey, right? Odysseus is anointed in oil, and we know that even the Mesopotamians are anointed in oil. So it seems to be a very, quite, even by Jesus's own estimation, like a very ancient tradition, right? And it just, I guess, continues on throughout like all of antiquity until, I'm guessing, what, the rise of the, you know, the more, I hate to say, but like the Catholic Church and really like the end of antiquity, beginning of like kind of the Middle Ages, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's no clearer example than in the canonization of the stories that became, I always want to say John Paul, Ringo, and what's his name, but you know what I mean. Those, you know, a bunch of you know, people interested in developing a hierarchical look, you know, hey, if you are part of the Catholic Church or part of these Christian organizations and you can't see that there were some downsides and some abuses and some really fucked up things, you know, I can't really talk to you. But if you can, then I think you can open your mind to the fact that these plant medicines being written out of history is a huge, and I think it's how we get from, you know, if you look at, I don't want to talk the whole time about Jesus, but like,
right,
you know, if you look at what Jesus said, he's just classically this groovy, open-hearted guy.
Yes, and Jesus was a dope dude. No pun intended.
Yeah. And if you look at the institutions that claim his legacy, they're, in my view of them, very repressive. Repressive of sexuality, repressive of women, repressive of other religious ideas, repressive of spirituality without dogma. All of these things, you know, the Dark Ages were driven by religious intolerance from these very groups. Right. So, you know, I think removing the central message of healing at that time was deliberate, and it worked. It created this incredibly powerful institution that dominated people's lives for centuries.
Absolutely, it did. It's funny because Stephanie is a Catholic and we got married in Catholic church. My father-in-law is Catholic. My mother-in-law is Catholic. But you won't see too many people that are harsher critics of the Catholic Church than Stephanie. And again, like, I think you said this perfectly, like, just because you can love something but also be critical of it at the same time. I think the United States of America is a perfect example of that. I love America, harshly critical, mainly of our government. Not exclusively, but mainly. So I think that's a great message. So kind of let's like fast forward a little bit. So towards the modern era, right? So the emergence of the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, right? I think things start to change maybe again. How familiar are you with that era? Or do you want to talk about maybe how the views kind of changed a little bit, especially in the early Americas? And how that's kind of affected almost the rest of like American and world history.
Sure. Big question.
Yeah, it's a huge question. I left it open-ended because I want you to, whatever you feel the most comfortable with, just dive into that.
Of course. Well, I think we also have a parallel history. You know, when we talk about hemp yes. is cannabis. It's mm-hmm. just been selectively bred for different properties. So like if you go to the farmer's market and you get an heirloom tomato, it might, you know, look kind of gnarly, but it is the most delicious tomato. And if you go to the store and you get one of those sort of round, drop it on the floor and it bounces tomatoes, they taste like nothing. Yeah. And the reason is they were bred for different purposes. Heirloom tomatoes were bred to be delicious and to be eaten by the people who grew them or somebody nearby. So they don't need a thick skin. They don't need to be shipped across the country. They don't need to be harvested by a robot, you know? And people still grow them in their backyards because those are the best tomatoes. So when you look at cannabis as a medicine or a drug, you know, I'm comfortable with calling it either and both. Right. And of course, many drugs are medicines. But when you look at hemp, it was bred to make strong rope that, and you know, the entire era of exploring / suppressing, oppressing the people you found when you got there, the age of exploration, which is really the age of colonizing, was powered by ships with hemp ropes and hemp sails. So that whole history, which doesn't, and that shows you how, also the fact that when prohibition comes to the United States, federal prohibition in 1937, the fact that hemp was thrown in with cannabis just shows you how irrational and self-harming these laws are. You know, right. You can't, you know, smoke hemp and get high. And so that's a whole other history. But then, you know, I think the other thing to remember is that prohibition isn't happening everywhere all at the same time. And, you know, one great story from the era you mentioned that we have an episode about is about a group called the Club de Hashishians, which is formed in Paris. And the beginning of this is that in the very, very late 1700s, Napoleon invaded Egypt. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that occurred during that invasion was that the French soldiers discovered hashish, because it was, you know, something that was, you know, either not existent in France, or certainly such a tiny phenomenon, you know, consuming cannabis to get high, to have no real evidence of it, to a place where this is a part of daily life. And where, you know, anywhere you are encountering the Islamic world, there's not an alcohol culture, or at least not an above ground alcohol culture, mm-hmm. because that is haram, that is forbidden. But hashish was celebrated. And there is an account of a decree that Napoleon gave that basically, I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, and I won't do the French accent, but says, knock it off with all the hash. You know, you're marching haphazardly, and it's hurting this war effort. But even by accounts of the time, that was ignored by a lot of the soldiers. And also, they started bringing hash back with them and seeds back with them. And this, you know, we see from this war of colonialism, from a European power going into Egypt, while flowing in the other direction is this plant consciousness. And fast forward a few decades, and this group springs up in Paris called the Club de Hashishians, which is some of the leading writers and thinkers and artists of that time. Dumas, who wrote The Three Musketeers, yes. Unless I'm getting it wrong. Am I getting it wrong?
No, that's right.
Baudelaire, two or three other really top-level French intellectuals of the era, and they would gather and they would almost sort of throw like a theme party. They would dress like Egyptians. They would recreate this coffee drink that was popular there with hash in it. And they would explore their consciousness. And there's, you know, little mentions of hash, for example, in some of their work. And there was also a sort of fad that sprung up at that time called flaneuring, which is a French word, which just basically means to take a walk without destination, to basically wander around. And based on the timing and the people involved, I'm pretty confident that it was just people who were experiencing hash for the first time and realizing that simply wandering around with cannabis consciousness in your brain can be quite a beautiful experience. It's one of my favorite things to do. You know, when we talk about cannabis, we also really talk about, like, you know, you talk about medicine as a use for it. You talk about, you know, wanting to end this prohibition as being incredibly mm-hmm. important to me. And then I think it just enhances so many other things in life. And one of my favorite things to do when I can is to travel. And when I travel, one of my favorite things to do, if it's safe to do where I am, is to just get really, really fucking baked and wander around and see what happens and be open to possibility and not have a destination. I think that's a very weedy way of seeing the world. And it's interesting to just, as you said, you know, to look at history is to see ourselves reflected. So that's kind of a great story from that time and era in cannabis history.
Yeah, no wonder it was called the Age of Enlightenment then, right? Mm-hmm. So moving on kind of from like the Age of Enlightenment, it seems that cannabis is very much so accepted again, right? Like the at least, I mean, I know in America, some of the very first laws surrounding like hemp cannabis was that like settlers had to grow it. Like you have to grow hemp. A complete opposite of like the, you know, the 30s, 50, you know, and almost like to the present day. I mean, in a lot of states, still to the in the United States, it's still illegal, like fully illegal. You can go to jail. Whereas like in, you know, where I live and where you live, you know, California and Portland respectively, or Los Angeles and Portland respectively, you can just walk down the street and find a dispensary.
Yeah. And actually that idea came around again of what you're talking about, of having to grow, there was a film made during World War II by the Department of Agriculture, mm-hmm. called Hemp for Victory. It was later suppressed and memory holed, as they say. But it's, you know, talking about the history of hemp, and then it talks about all of the uses for hemp in the current war effort. So no, we're not talking about ancient, you know, we're not talking about ancient history from where you and I sit, but during World War II, they were talking about how we're going to grow hemp to win World War II, how we're going to fight the fucking Nazis with this plant. And then in classic, you know, governmental fashion, this was after the federal prohibition of it, but, you know, it was considered so important to the war effort that they made this film and they started this program. And then when the war ended, it took decades until a researcher named Jack Herer, a real hero of the cannabis movement, he recovered a lot of this history. Somebody who was really kind of a North Star person of my podcast, because he, in the modern era in the United States, when prohibition was at its peak and when all of this information was suppressed and when there was no internet and simply finding this information was incredibly difficult, he wrote a book called The Emperor Wears No Clothes, referring to the story. And he also, and so in that research, he saw some reference to this film, and he, you know, of course, first thing, wrote to the Library of Congress and said, I would like a copy of this film. And they said, no such film exists. Now, I imagine the person who said that, just, it wasn't in any record that they had. Right. So he went to the primary, I don't know if it was exactly the Library of Congress where he found it or in a different archive, but he spent months in Washington, D.C., searching for this film until he found it. And then the government tried to claim that it was a fake, and he proved that it wasn't. And so it just shows you how serious and consistent the effort to keep people from this plant has been by the authorities. And then you have to ask yourself the question, why? And mm-hmm. all the things that I referenced earlier as well, as far as people going to prison, having their homes raided, having their children taken away, the disproportionate targeting of people of color. Why would all of this be done to to try to unsuccessfully, by the way, eradicate this beneficial plant. And in my thinking about it, and these prohibitions go back, you know, it's not just in the United States, and it's not always based on racism. There's very homogenized societies that also have prohibited cannabis. So that's certainly a huge driver of it in the United States, but it's not the end-all be-all of why this happened. And so I think that for me, it's kind of comes down to this. It's not that, I think it makes you question authority. I think it makes you question all kinds of things. And one of the things it causes people to question is authority. Now, if the authorities were doing a good job and, you know, wielding power judiciously and for the benefit of people, I don't think they'd be too worried about being questioned. Right. If we were all like, fuck, man, this is kind of a paradise on earth where all people are treated equally and with human dignity. Fucking government's doing a great job. Like, if that
I'd love to live in that reality, by the way.
I would love to live in that reality, but we don't. And so the lengths that they're willing to go and the real just is crime against humanity. Let me put another thing on the table. When I talk about this as a crime against humanity, it's so obvious going to prison over a fucking plant. But right. Also, and this is hard to say, did your aunt go through chemotherapy and not smoke weed? Because that's a fucking crime against humanity if you have ever. And that's just one use, one medicinal use of this plant. But it's one of the ones where the difference is so visible and immediate and dramatic. The same with these seizure disorders. But right. It affects so many people. And I just tell you, there is not a person who hates this plant so much that if they understood how much it can help in that specific situation, that they wouldn't change their mind, that they could. I have never met a person who's such a big asshole that they would keep a loved one or somebody that was important to them or, God forbid, themselves have to go through what chemotherapy can do to somebody without having the incredible, this plant relieves nausea. This right. plant will allow, and think about also this, I always say, cannabis is such a powerful medicine that it can get you through chemotherapy, but so gentle of a medicine that there is no lethal dose.
Right, and that, and we have, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that is such a unique point, right? I don't know of any other drug that, or even any other substance, right? Even water, right? Fundamental building block of us. You have too much water, it's called drowning, right? You can die, and you will die. I mean, what? I mean, millions of people throughout human history have died from drowning. So, you know, the fact that, like, no matter how much you smoke, no matter how much you ingest, you can't die from it is astounding, honestly.
And I will veer off history for just 1 second, because the reason for that is that our bodies have what is called the endocannabinoid system. And it is, in essence, the root level operating system of the human body that keeps all of the other systems regulated like a thermostat. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why cannabis is such a good medicine for so many different kinds of conditions. Chronic pain, seizure disorder, nausea, ALS, you know, different conditions with different causes. But because you're going down to a root level operating system, cannabinoids, THC, CBD, cannabinoid means a compound that is in essence only found in cannabis. There's
right.
super rare exceptions that's not worth worrying about. But in essence, that's how unique this plant is. But also there are receptors in the human body that fit these cannabinoids. And the body also makes its own, in essence, analogs of these cannabinoids. And so that is why this is such an incredible medicine. And it is also why being denied this medicine is so antithetical to what it means to be a human. And to get a kind of a history angle on it, I recently had a doctor on the podcast. And because of these biases and these stigmas and this bullshit, there are doctors graduating today who are maybe getting an hour of education on the endocannabinoid system, a system that regulates the entire functioning of the body. And if your doctor is over 30, unless your doctor educated themselves, they know nothing about this. Now, I would hope most doctors are at least aware of the existence of this system at this point, but maybe not, you know, because they're taught how to prescribe medicine. And I don't want to go off on the medical establishment. I want to talk to you. Right. I'm so happy and excited to be talking with a history weirdo and two history weirdos. So, but you know, I do want to, you know, at least make that point.
No, it's worth bringing up at least because it is part of history how doctors and the medical establishment doesn't really talk about cannabis. I mean, and especially now, and if that was it, like that would be kind of questionable, but like, okay, I could maybe see your point. But the fact that there is this endocannabinoid system within our bodies that's hardly, maybe, like you said, like med school's years, and they might take a couple hours to talk about it. That seems criminal, honestly.
Yeah, and I forgot where we started, which is why there is no lethal dose, or right, only a highly, highly theoretical lethal dose, is because your body is hardwired to absorb cannabis, and because it is not toxic in the way other things are. Whereas, you know, if I opened, you can't see it because of the screen, but yeah. I have a little like cabinet behind me where I keep a few bottles of liquor, and I have more than a lethal dose of alcohol within arm's reach by happenstance.
Right, almost same here. My bar cart's just right off screen, and I have a lot of whiskey. So yeah, I hear you, man. That's wild. I think to kind of like wrap this up, you know, we've discovered, you know, when weed was first, you know, harvested or where it first grew, and we've worked all the way up to like the kind of the current era. And it seems now that we're also sort of in a transitionary period, right? 20 years ago, marijuana, cannabis, whatever you want to call it, was, I think most Americans were anti that. Now it's overwhelmingly people are supporting it. So, so you see, obviously, it is affecting our economy, but you also see these massive corporations kind of coming into the cannabis space, and you know they've been very questionable in the pharmaceutical industry. So, I guess my question to you now that like you know, based off where we currently are, like, what's the best course of action for, you know, people in the industry, for consumers, for just like the average American? Like, what, I guess, can we do to make sure that cannabis succeeds and is legalized? But also, how can we make sure that, you know, it's grown in an effective way, not only an effective way, but in a safe way? And it isn't like, it doesn't become like the new pharmaceutical industry.
Or the new Monsanto.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, you know, a constant threat. I'm going to say this, you know, I think that if this, because I know I'm talking to all kind, I'm not on my show, I'm on your show. So I'm talking to people who may not have any relationship to cannabis, might have a casual relationship to cannabis, or, you know, might be right in the center of the Venn diagram of our shows and love cannabis. So
right.
It's a different answer for each of them. I would say hey, if you're out there and I sound like a complete fucking lunatic, and you believe an alternate story about this plant being evil and dangerous, etc. And I should also say, I don't discount, people do have dependency issues with cannabis. And I acknowledge that, and I don't disparage that. I would just say, if you have to choose the thing that you're going to have a dependency issue with, you're way better off than alcohol. You're way better off than pharmaceutical drugs. You're, in my opinion, way better off than being addicted to the internet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah. I do want to just, you know, acknowledge that and meet people where they live. The other thing is, driving while intoxicated on anything is its own issue and not something that you should be doing. But I would say to those people, look at the history. You know, and if you can
speak in our language,
yeah, if you can honestly look at the history of cannabis and come to that same conclusion, I don't have anything else to tell you. For the people who have like myself, feel very connected to this plant, get involved locally. If cannabis is legal where you live, it is a fucked up, oppressive government system full of corruption that you can help try to make better. And if cannabis is illegal where you live, you can work to try to end one of the really most racist and oppressive government programs going, and also try to push that process towards a better version of legalization that works for small farmers, that works for workers in the industry, that works for small local communities, and doesn't just go immediately from locking people in cages to huge corporate profits.
Right.
And I would say this, you know, it is a worthwhile place to put your efforts towards making a better world. And then I've got really great news for the people who have a casual relationship with cannabis. The way that you can help is by buying the best cannabis in the world, and the best cannabis are available to you, and that is cannabis that is going to be grown outdoors organically by small family farmers who care about the plant and who care about their local community and who are looking to make a living and not a killing. And it just takes a little extra effort to seek that out, and depending where you live, it can be hard. And if you don't have even if you are in the underground, you can make those efforts, but it is a lot harder. But what we really need is for people, the same thing that has happened with food over the last couple of decades, where people have become much more conscious of where their food comes from and who grew it and what the environmental impact of that is, what the working conditions for people is, where that money goes. Is it going into making a better and more stable society, or is it just going to corporate profits? And and the great news is, when you start to source your food that way, whether it's at a farmer's market or a restaurant, you eat a lot better. And I can assure you that if you are looking for organically grown small family farm cannabis, you are gonna smoke a lot better than any alternative.
Absolutely. Any recommendations for our California listeners?
I don't want to call out a specific brand because there's so many good ones. I think it's this, you know. And then there's places, just like in the food world, where they're going to pretend to be that. So right. I think better than to point to a specific farm or brand or anything, I would say don't be fooled. Do your due diligence. And, you know, there's, of course, we have what's called the Emerald Triangle in California, Mendocino, Humboldt, and Trinity counties, which have their own incredible history of resistance to this, helicopter raids and just insane government response. Yeah. And that, I would say, that area, now, just because it comes from there doesn't mean it was grown that way. But if I was looking, ask your bud tender, ask the smartest person you know about weed locally, or go on the internet and do some research and look to support those communities. They played such a huge role in fighting back against this prohibition. And then the other thing I would say is there are also what are called social equity brands, which are coming out of communities that were also disproportionately targeted by the war on drugs, but we're looking at people of color and companies like that. I think you can also feel really good about supporting, but again, there's a lot of people trying to claim that who aren't. So you're still also going to have to do your research. Unfortunately, you can't call cannabis organic because that is a federally regulated word, right. and cannabis is still federally illegal, but there are some parallel certifications that are organic or better. So that's another good thing to keep an eye out for.
Okay, awesome. That's great to know. So it sounds like stay organic organic, quote unquote, stay local, and small family farms tend to be your best bet. And if you go, you can't grill and outdoor.
Yes, or sun grown is kind of the industry term, and I also just believe that, you know, indoor lighting is a very narrow spectrum of light. A lot of weed is grown indoors, and it might look and smell very appealing. It has been bred and grown for that bag appeal, as we used to call it. But there is a complexity to sunlight and soil, right, that you, when you are going to bring, you know, I would say smoke, and of course there's many ways to consume cannabis, but eating is such an intimate act. Smoking, to bring something into your human lungs, think carefully about that. Mm-hmm. And I should mention, you know, there is no, cannabis is not a cause, cannabis smoking is not a cause of lung cancer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you are bringing whatever is in that jar deeply into the tissues of your lungs. So,
right,
you know, aside from, I think sun-grown cannabis has a much better, high to it. It's also, if it's organic and soil grown and sun grown, going to be the healthiest for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I guess with smoking anything, right, there's always going to be a harm. There's always going to be some possible, at the very least, carcinogenic effect. But it sounds like you're mitigating that by doing something or doing it the more healthy way, I should say.
And I would also say, and I know this is going to seem like a far out concept to people, but cannabis has strong anti-tumor and anti-cancer properties. And what this science ultimately shows, and here's another sort of lesson in history. One of the people who was, doing these studies back in the day where they would have a monkey smoke 800 pounds of weed a day for 2 weeks. Now that's an exaggeration, but yeah, huge one, like gas mask shits. And then they'd be like, "Oh, look, it's irritating their lungs." Well, yeah, I would think that if you sat in a, but there's irritation and harmful parts of smoking. So one is edibles. Eating cannabis is probably the healthiest, best way to do it if you can do that. But also because the anti-tumor and anti-cancer properties of cannabis seem to outweigh whatever harmful effects there would be from smoking. And this same researcher eventually, who was cited by Reagan and everybody, oh, this is the research, later recanted. And this is a UCLA, professor, I would just say, especially when it comes to the medicine stuff, and even now, whenever you see a study come out about cannabis, and there are harms, and it is important to study things, I don't knee-jerk reject science, but so often a study will still come out that is so skewed and so poorly designed and so designed to show a harm despite evidence, and then that will get picked up in the press by people who don't ever read the study. Mm-hmm. I've been debunking these things for 15 years. I would just say, when you see a study or you see a thing in the news, that can't be the end of your process. If you're listening to this show, you're a thoughtful person, able to think and research for yourself. And hey, if you look into it and you decide, oh, that does sound legit, more power to you. But don't, given the track record of propaganda and lies, you cannot take any of this stuff at face value.
Yeah, if you still trust the government at this point, man, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. Well, David, I think that about wraps it up. And I just want to thank you so much for being the very first guest on the History for Weirdos podcast. So this is definitely a big moment for me personally, and for Steph, who unfortunately obviously couldn't make it to this episode. So thank you so much, man.
Oh, it is truly, truly an honor and a real pleasure. I guess I would say, I think this is going to be your 420 episode. So I'm going to say happy 420 to all you weirdos, whether you celebrate or not. You certainly have somebody in your life who loves this plant, and you can be pretty cool by wishing them a happy 420 and just showing them that you accept their lifestyle and their journey with this plant. And if you've already come over to the green side, I'll blaze this one up for you in advance of 420, and happy to be a weirdo myself. So thanks so much for having me.
Well, weirdos, that was Andrew's interview with David. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please share our very first interview with someone else who may enjoy it. This helps History for Weirdos grow, and we really appreciate your support as always. If you happen to celebrate, we hope you have a very happy 420. Until next time, weirdos, adios.